"Delete it?" said James with wonder and doubt in his voice.
"I imagine a red delete button. Mentally push it, and the memory is gone," said Holmes. "Otherwise, my brain would be a grab bag of odds and ends, rather than a finely tuned engine for ratiocination."
"Delete button," said Colonel Rice and shook his head. "Now I've heard everything."
9. Friday, April 14, 2:45 p.m. Mr. Drummond, Holmes, James, and the Colonel had toured the upper regions of the agriculture building, the east entrance peristyle, the gigantic manufactures and liberal arts building, and the south side promenade of the electricity building, sharing a quick and late lunch with Colonel Rice in the canvas-covered temporary cantina set up for the workers. It was at the northeast corner of the agriculture building that Holmes pointed to a post set at the end of the narrow promenade. A cable ran from the post down for several hundred feet to a 7 or 8 foot tall, lighted channel marker 30 feet or more from the seawall.
"Does this have a purpose?" asked Holmes. "Perhaps holding down the agriculture building in high winds?"
Colonel Rice clamped down on his cigar stub and grinned.
"There's another one just like it at the southeast corner of the manufactures and liberal arts building across the way. Someone had the idea of dangling the flags of all the nations along the cables so that folks on the ships docking at the end of the pier would feel sort of welcomed with open arms."
"Is it still to come, then?" asked Holmes.
Rice shook his head.
"The halyards just wouldn't rig right. The wind was tearing the test flags all to hell, so the idea was abandoned. They just haven't gotten around to removing the cables yet."
"That cable is rather low to the beacons, light posts, whatever they are," said Drummond. "Isn't that a navigation hazard for small boats?"
Rice shook his head again. "Those beacons are there to warn away even the smallest crafts. All the area underwater out to the beacons' tiny little concrete islands is filled with chunks of rock and concrete dumped when we built the seawall. They'd rip the bottom out of a skiff."
James was deeply impressed by the peristyle, with its long row of Corinthian columns and great triumphal arch through which passengers arriving from the water would enter the fair and see the grand view.
"The peristyle connects the little casino building at the end of the main casino pier there to the south to the music hall there on the north end," said Colonel Rice. 47 giant columns, one for each of the states and territories. This has a promenade up there, but just accessible by a stairway at the south end."
"By all means, let us enjoy the view," said Holmes.
Above the Columbian Arch at the center of the peristyle promenade, which did offer an amazing view both into the White City and out onto Lake Michigan, they were perfectly lined up with the front of the administration building where the president would be giving his talk.
"What is the distance, do you estimate, Colonel?" asked Holmes.
Rice squinted.
530 yards? No more than 550.
"Certainly that is too far for someone with a mere rifle to aim and shoot with any certainty," said Henry James. Rice, Drummond, and Holmes exchanged glances.
Rice spoke first. "The best of modern military rifles can give you 5-inch groups at up to 1,000 yards, he said softly, removing the cigar as out of respect for such an achievement.
Rice turned to Holmes.
"Do you know what kind of weapon this Lucan Adler intends to use?"
"Yes," said Holmes. "We believe we do. He's assassinated 4 powerful figures in Europe since last autumn, and in each case he's used a Model 1893 Mauser rifle, most probably with a 20-power telescopic sight attached. He doesn't leave casings behind, but each dead man seems to have been killed by 7mm rimless bullets. The 93 Mauser, which was released early last autumn in major sales to Spain and the Spanish troops in Cuba, is a bolt action with a 5-round clip."
Colonel Rice seemed to grimace.
"I don't know the Mausers, much less this new one. Do you know the muzzle velocity?"
2,300 feet per second, said Holmes.
And actual operational range?
A little over 2,000 yards. I believe 2,160 is the precise number.
This meant nothing to James, but it seemed to affect Colonel Rice almost viscerally. For the first time, the stocky gentleman not only took the soggy stogie out of his mouth, but removed his worn derby and rubbed his balding head.
My God, he whispered. If we'd had that rifle at Gettysburg.
Holmes nodded.
You could have used aimed fire, individual targets, almost as soon as the Confederates came out of the trees a mile away across that wide, deadly space, with five rounds without reloading.
Rice let out a deep breath.
Well, it doesn't matter much. Your Lucan Adler fellow will want to get in as close as he can.
Why is that? Asked James. Especially if he can shoot a target a little more than a mile away. Rice smiled.
A man ain't a paper target, he said,
and James sensed that the failure in grammar was deliberate with this man who'd ended the war as a brigadier general.
Walking at an average rate, 2 miles per hour, a man walks about 2 feet in the time it would take a bullet to reach him.
He pointed at the administration building due west of us down the long lagoon.
That would be a miss. Of course, President Cleveland will be standing still and facing this way, but the shooter has probably sighted in his rifle he'd have to hold over 18 inches.
I don't understand, said James.
Agent Drummond held out his hands as if framing the target area in front of the distant administration building.
That means, Mr. James, he said softly, that to shoot accurately enough to hit the president in the chest, and we admit that it is a broad target, Lucan Adler would have to use his telescopic sight to aim about 18 inches high, say, at the top of the president's forehead.
I would think that shooting for the head would be preferable, said James,
appalled at hearing his own words.
Colonel Rice said, Our heads move around a lot more than we think, especially when giving a speech. Center of the body's mass is the surest target.
They were all silent for a long, sickening moment. Finally, Rice said,
Well, shall we tour the manufacturers and electricity buildings, have some lunch, and get this over with?
Holmes, Drummond, and James followed him down from the peristyle promenade without speaking. The manufacturers and liberal arts building was by far the largest and most imposing structure they visited. The interior was chaos this day, a very controlled chaos once carefully observed, as thousands upon thousands of major displays were uncrated, assembled, and made ready. Far across the vast, cluttered floor, James caught a glimpse of an elegant telescope that must have been at least 60 feet tall.
You should have seen this hall when it was empty, said Colonel Rice as they waited for the Otis Hale elevator to drop down in clear sight,
the car now seeming to be suspended in midair among the iron beams some 200 feet above them.
We had the dedication ceremony in late October last year, continued Rice. This floor's 32 acres, and it was filled that day with more than 140,000 Chicago folk. The carpenters had to build a platform that would hold 5,000 grandees in their little yellow chairs. Ex-Mayor Harrison had a seat up on the platform, but he spent most of the time shaking hands with every one of the 140-some thousand citizens standing. And it was a cold day, cold as a witch's tit. Men kept their overcoats and hats on, and women tried to hide down in their fur collars and keep their hands in their mink muffs when they weren't waving white hankies to the music. And it was a bloody long ceremony, too. After an hour or so, I heard a sound like a marching army approaching, and realized it was all the men standing out there stamping their feet to stay warm. You could see your breath in front of you during the entire overblown ceremony, and I swear that after the first half hour, little clouds formed under them iron trusses 20 stories up there, just from our breath.
Could anyone hear any of the speeches? Asked James.
About 10 people up on that platform and closest to the podium, said Colonel Rice.
The place was so damn big and echoey that the organizers had to use ex-military fellows I provided to wave semaphore flags to cue the 500-musician orchestra and 5,000-voice choir when it was their time to play or sing.
Did anything interesting come out of that day? Asked Drummond.
Well, said Rice, some fellow who edits some children's magazine wrote out a pledge that the Bureau of Education sent to every damned school in the country, so that on that October 21 dedication day last year, all the young brats in all the schools of the nation would be contributing something to their nation.
A pledge? James said dubiously.
I don't remember it, but for the beginning, said Rice. It goes, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands.
Forcing schoolchildren to recite a national pledge doesn't sound very American to me, said James.
No, agreed Holmes. It sounds German. Very German.
The elevator ride up to the promenade level was a surprise for Henry James. It literally took his breath away. The Otis Hale Company had built a super high-speed elevator that was a simple cage, open on three sides, and it whisked upward so quickly through rings of electric lights and occasional high platforms that one felt both exposed to the height and heavier at the same moment. When it came to a stop at the top, the rear doors opening to the promenade, James thought for a moment that his feet had left the floor of the lift.
That elevator should be a major attraction all on its own, said James when he could get his breath back.
I'm sure it will be, said Colonel Rice.
I'm not sure I would care to ride it more than once, said Drummond.
The promenade on the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building was called the Observation Deck, and it went all the way around the 32-acre building. Instead of stone or plaster railings, the barrier was a simple metal chain-link fence, which made the sense of height all the more palpable. The views were astonishing. James realized that if Mr. Ferris ever got his giant wheel built, citizens on this observation deck would be looking at it almost at the height of its highest carriages as it revolved. Naturally, Holmes, Drummond, and Rice were interested only in the parts of the observation deck that would allow a madman to murder a president from afar.
Three corners of the observation deck have one of these huge searchlights, Holmes said as if to himself.
Rice answered anyway.
Yes, sir. They're German and terribly bright and focused. They will be used to illuminate buildings, fountains, the wooded island, and other things during the night. One of these lights could show us a rabbit a mile away.
Each German searchlight had a 6-foot square black base about 2.5 feet high. The steel was painted with black enamel. They were at the southwest corner of the observation deck, the one that gave the best view of the administration building, an area where President Cleveland would be standing in a little more than 2 weeks. Holmes crouched, pointed to a lock along one side of the base of the searchlight, and said,
"Would you happen to have a key for this compartment, Colonel Rice?"
Again, Rice grinned around his cigar stub.
"You've heard me clinking and clanking along the last 2 hours. I've got a key on this ring for everything in the fairgrounds."
In a moment, he produced a small key that unlocked the compartment. Holmes lay on his belly to look inside, and Drummond joined him. But James refused to get his suit dirty doing so, and he crouched as best he could to look over the detective's shoulder. The dark space showed various thick, insulated wires going through the floor and some iron support struts, but was mostly empty. The knee-high black steel square was obviously there primarily to be a base for the 7-foot-high heavy searchlight.
"Thank you, Colonel Rice," said Holmes, getting to his feet and brushing off his trousers and jacket. "Shall we stroll to the southeast corner now?"
The last of the morning's threatening clouds had disappeared, and now all four men leaned on the metal fence to enjoy the spring sunlight.
"Harder shot from here," said Mr. Drummond. "Adds almost another 100 yards to a shot from the southwest corner we were at."
"Quite true," said Holmes. "And it would be awkward steadying a rifle on that low steel fence.
But a man standing on the searchlight stand,
he pointed his cane behind him without turning to look,
would have the ridges on the searchlight itself to brace a rifle. How long is a Model 93 Mauser?
Asked the colonel.
48 inches,
Holmes said at once, but then he smiled thinly.
Without its bayonet.
The electricity building pleased James the most of the four major buildings in peristyle they'd inspected so far. It had a delightful curving promenade that looked down at the lagoons, bridges, and, for much of the southeast side, the front of the administration building. There was a large and elegant statue of Benjamin Franklin at the graceful entrance to the building, with already the smell of ozone from the voluminous interior. Holmes showed less interest in the promenade deck than he did in the 8 high spires at various corners of the structure.
Steps for the public up to them?
Asked Mr. Drummond.
Sure, said the colonel. Those rooftop spires are 170 feet in the air, and the open arches at the top provide one of the best views in the entire grounds.
Looking out the broad opening from the spire closest to the administration building, Holmes sighted down the length of his cane.
A slight side shot, but the president standing alone to give his speech won't have Secret Service men or anyone else standing next to him then. The other notables will be seated, yes?
Yes, said Colonel Rice.
Less than 100 yards, said Holmes.
Yes, said Colonel Rice.
And that was all for the electricity building. After a fast and late luncheon under sun-warmed canvas, Holmes said,
You'll pardon us a minute, I hope, Mr. James,
and stepped to one side to talk with Colonel Rice and Mr. Drummond for about 15 minutes, while James drank another cup of coffee. When the conference was over, Drummond came over to James.
It's been a delight and deep honor to meet you, Mr. James. Should we cross paths again, I hope it will not be presumptuous of me to bring a few of your novels to sign for me. They would be the pride of my collection and a legacy to my children.
Of course, said James.
Drummond shook hands with him, bowed slightly, and left the sun-warm dining tent. James noted Holmes and Rice's discussion was over, so he joined the two men. As Holmes was shaking hands goodbye with Rice, the colonel said,
There's one thing you haven't asked about or mentioned, Mr. Holmes.
Yes?
Wherever your Lucan Adler sniper chooses to shoot from, there's going to be the slight problem of him getting away after the fact. As we've discussed, upon such a terrible event as the shooting of the president, the Colombian Guard will close and lock all gates immediately. I have telephone lines to every exit. No boats will be allowed to leave from the pier. Is your man suicidal? Wanting to be martyred to anarchism?
Not in the least, said Holmes.
Lucan Adler has never carried out an assassination without having a brilliant escape plan in place.
Colonel Rice gestured to the boulevard along the lagoon where they stood.
We can shut off access to the promenades and towers, as you've asked, but that parade ground and all these side streets will be filled with more than 100,000 panicked people. And not one of them will get out without being checked out by police or my Colombian guard.
It is a bit of a challenge to think of a sensible escape route, is it not, Colonel?
Said Holmes. The detective nodded, tipped his hat, and turned away. Henry James said his own goodbye to Colonel Rice and followed Holmes through white city streets filled with great crates, rubble, straw, and thousands of workmen. 10. Saturday, April 15, 8:30 a.m. Henry James's 50th birthday was as cold, lonely and awful as he might have imagined it if he were writing a short story dipped deeply in pathos. James had lain awake for much of the night, fighting a nausea that sent him rushing to the lavatory 3 times before a faint dawn began contouring the outlines of his hotel windows. As he checked out, he had tickets for a 9 a.m. train to New York. He knew that Sam Clemens had left 2 days earlier, and the clerk, when queried, said that Mr. Holmes had checked out very, very early. The rain that had only threatened the previous morning was coming down now in a cold and unrelenting downpour. The chilly air felt more like November with winter beginning in earnest than mid-April.
Even the fancily clad doormen were huddled under their umbrellas and looking sour this dark, freezing day. The previous late afternoon, when he and Holmes had returned to the Great Northern from their odd tour of an assassin's eye view of the Great Columbian Exposition and World's Fair, James had been surprised to find two telegrams waiting for him. The first was from Henry Adams and read,
"A slightly premature happy birthday, Harry. Stop. I know you must be eager to return to London and your magnificent work, but I sincerely hope that you return to Washington to stay with me as my guest when your business is concluded. Stop. We are old friends, Harry, and in a way I am requesting the pleasure of your company for the next couple of weeks in Clover's beloved name. Stop. Happy birthday, my dear friend."
James was stunned. He had no idea how Adams had found out that he was in Chicago, much less where he was staying in Chicago, and he knew it was highly unusual that Adams was inviting him as a house guest. He'd rarely had guests stay in his huge home in the years since Clover died. The second telegram was from the Hayes.
"Happy, happy birthday, Harry. Stop. We understand you may be celebrating this especially auspicious day while in transit, but Clara and I deeply and sincerely hope that you will accept Adams's offer and return to Washington for a while before heading across the Atlantic. Stop. We have so much we want to talk to you about, in person. Stop. Cabot Lodge has laid on the special train to the Chicago Fair opening for April 29, with special admission passes for all of us, and it would be Clara's and my deepest wish that you will join us on that expedition. Stop. Happy birthday."
James had accosted Holmes in the lobby before the detective had reached the elevator to go up to his room.
"Did you cable the Hayes and Henry Adams that we were, that I was staying here in the Great Northern?" snapped James.
Holmes seemed a bit taken aback by the writer's ferocity.
"Of course I did, old fellow. I would have thought you'd want your whereabouts known to some of your dearest friends, especially right before your 50th birthday."
James felt even angrier at this comment, but refused to satisfy Holmes's sardonic sense of humor by asking how the detective knew that the 15th was his birthday.
"Shall we dine together tonight at that interesting little Italian restaurant just down Jackson Street?" asked Holmes. "The concierge here strongly recommends it. And we may not be seeing each other again for a while."
James started to say no, stopped, started to ask a question, and stopped again. He just stood there with the telegrams about his dreaded 50th birthday crumpled in his hand and glared at Sherlock Holmes.
"Good then," said Holmes. "I shall meet you in the lobby promptly at 8 p.m.
During the night, between his bouts of nausea, an old foe of his along with constipation and diarrhea, James had weighed his decision. He'd studied the railway tables. A train leaving the New North Station at 9:45 a.m. went to Pittsburgh, where he could transfer for a nonstop express to Washington. The train to New York left from the old downtown station at 9 o'clock and passed through Cleveland and Buffalo on its way to New York, where he could immediately book passage to Portsmouth on the highly praised new transatlantic steamer, the SS United States. In the end, it was the thought of the sunny warmth of his Devere Gardens rooms, his waiting writing desk, the salons he would be revisiting, the country houses of gentlefolk he'd be invited to, that and the visceral sense of safe encirclement by all his books that made him decide for New York and home. He'd found a porter to carry his baggage piled high on a cart and bought his ticket at the downtown station when, concealed as he was behind the high mound of his luggage and an iron post, he saw Professor James Moriarty moving up and down the first-class coaches, peering in the windows.
"He's hunting for me,"
was James's first gut-chilling thought, a thought that carried all the weight of certainty. Two thuggish-looking men came up and reported quickly to Professor Moriarty, who dispatched them up and down the line of waiting cars. Moriarty stepped aboard and began striding through the first-class cars. James could watch his advance. Like a high-domed scarecrow with white straw hair, a mortician's overcoat, and long strangler's fingers, as Moriarty strode from carriage to carriage. It made no sense that Moriarty would be looking for him, for Henry James. He was sure he'd not been seen on the evening he'd lain on that terrible beam, high over the heads of Moriarty and his small army of anarchists and thieves. The only person he'd told was Sherlock Holmes. But Holmes would have informed Drummond, the Washington and Chicago chiefs of police, and God knows how many other people here in the States and across Europe, to put them on their guard for the assassinations and uprisings of May 1st. Now it made perfect sense. James knew of Moriarty's vast crime networks across Europe and even in the United States. Someone in police enforcement, so many of them crooked in this gilded age, had told one of Moriarty's operatives. It was possible, of course, that Moriarty and his thugs were checking the train for Sherlock Holmes, and for all James knew, Holmes might be on it and murdered at any moment. But deep down, Henry James knew. Professor James Moriarty and his killers are looking for me this cold and rainy morning. As if confirming his intuition, Moriarty stepped out of the coaches and stood looking as three other thugs came up to him for orders. James stared at Moriarty's terribly long, long fingers with their long yellow nails, his hands on his hips now as he showed visible exasperation. The fingers were like great white spiders crawling up black velvet. Moriarty dispatched the three thugs and then turned quickly to stare in James's direction, but not before James ducked down behind his piled high mass of luggage. It took half a minute for James to work up the nerve to peek again, and he let out a long breath when he saw that Moriarty was again walking the length of the train, looking in all uncurtained windows.
"Shall I load your luggage now, sir?"
said the porter who'd been waiting patiently and showing no expression at James's sudden pallor or his absurd concealment.
"No, no," said James. "Find me a cab, any cab, as quickly as you can, and get these things loaded equally quickly. Here, for your trouble."
He handed the porter some bill from his wallet, but it had been so long since he'd trafficked in American money, it might have been a $50 bill or a $1 bill. Either way, the porter touched his cap and said,
"At once, sir."
James kept the baggage between himself and Moriarty all the way out to the busy cab stand, nodded his head when the porter pointed to an expensive closed carriage cab, held his breath while the trunks were loaded with maddening slowness, and breathed again only when the cab started moving quickly away from the central station and Professor James Moriarty. James, obviously still feeling edgy, almost jumped when the trap door opened above him for a second, just slitted to keep the pouring rain out, and the driver called down,
"Where to, sir?"
"The new North Station,"
said James in a strangely high voice.
"And quickly, please. I have to catch a 9:30 train. There's an extra quid in it if you get me there with time to spare."
"A quid, sir?"
asked the driver out there in the downpour.
$5 extra if you get me there at all possible speed and with time to spare before that 9:30 train's departure," said James.
The driver used the whip. The carriage flew through traffic as though there were a Derby stakes race in progress. James had to brace both hands against the seat cushions or to be thrown left and right as the racing cab swerved around all slower traffic. Other drivers and pedestrians shouted profanities as James's carriage soaked them through with splashes. The night before, at dinner, James had asked Holmes, "What are you doing next?" Holmes, already smoking his cigarette after quickly finishing his dinner, touched a finger to his tongue to capture a mote of tobacco.
"Oh, several things have to be looked into here and there. I should be busy until we meet again on Mr. Cabot Lodge's private train on the 28th.
James had to use all his control to avoid near shouting,
"I won't be on Lodge's damn train, and I won't be your Boswell. And I don't appreciate being abandoned like this in a city strange to me on the eve of my birthday. And I'm tired, and I'm going home."
He'd said none of that, of course. A graceful telegram, two graceful telegrams sent from New York before his ship sailed, would send his thanks and regrets, to Henry Adams and the Hays. Now, after his wildly whipping and racing cabbie had gotten him more or less in one piece to North Station, with plenty of time to spare, and he'd purchased his first-class tickets to Pittsburgh and then straight on to Washington, Henry James sat in his almost empty and overheated compartment, rested his face against the cool glass of the window, and watched the black canyons of Chicago fall behind in the rain. He looked away as the train passed through a fringe industrial wasteland with slag heaps and squalid homes, looking for all the world like a clumsy American imitation of a Dickensian nightmare landscape.
Happy birthday, Henry James,
he thought as they moved out into the country, and the rain, impossibly, pounded down even more heavily.
You're 50 years old.
At that moment, he found himself wishing that he'd done what he'd gone to the Seine that night to do, meant to do, had steeled himself to do at that dark river. It had been raining that night as well. Part 4. 1. On Monday, April 24, after a whirlwind visit to more than half a dozen large American cities, Sherlock Holmes returned to Washington and checked into the same Kirkwood House Hotel at 12th Street Northwest and Pennsylvania Avenue, where he'd stayed earlier. He knew it was dangerous to do so. If Lucan Adler had been searching him out, he would know about Holmes's earlier stay there and have someone keeping a lookout for him. But this part of Holmes's American visit had to be dangerous. If he could lure Lucan Adler to him before May 1st, it would be the best for everyone. Save, perhaps, for Sherlock Holmes. Early that spring evening, he went to the address near DuPont Circle that Mrs. Gaddis, the retired schoolteacher in her alley carriage house apartment in Boston, had given him. This was also a calculated risk. Holmes did not believe that the odds favored Lucan Adler being there for long stretches of time, but there was no doubt that the assassin visited there. It was a stately brick house on a quiet street just off the circle. When Holmes knocked on the door, a tiny woman, barely 4 feet tall, dressed out in European livery of a maid, opened the door and squinted up at him. "Is Mrs. Rebecca Lorne Baxter home?" asked Holmes, removing his hat.
"Ni pani ni esteres domo,"
said the tiny maid.
"Oh, a shame," said Holmes. "Would you please give her my card and this message?"
He handed the dwarf maid his business card and an envelope containing a short message.
"Irene, would you be kind enough to meet me tomorrow evening, Tuesday, between 7 and 8 p.m. at Clover Adams's memorial? S. Holmes."
The maid took the card and the envelope without saying a word, in Polish or any other language, and shut the door. Holmes walked slowly away from the house and back to DuPont Circle. But all the time he was still in view of the house, the spider webs of scars on his back itched as if someone had painted a target on his back with turpentine. 2. Holmes arrived at Rock Creek Cemetery just before 7 p.m. He told the cab driver not to wait. One way or the other, he would not need a cab home this night. The sun had just disappeared behind the forest to the west of the cemetery grounds, but the soft spring twilight lingered and promised to light the sky for most of the next hour. He walked directly to the Clover Adams Memorial. He had his sword cane in one hand and the little lemon squeezer pistol in a jacket pocket, but he knew that neither would be of any use if Lucan Adler was lying in wait with his sniper rifle. He'd stipulated this night, Tuesday, to give Irene Adler a full day to contact Lucan with the information about this meeting. He knew from his terrible experience in the Himalayas that it was true that one does not hear the rifle bullet, or in his case, 3 steel-cased bullets, that rips through your flesh, since the bullet travels well above the speed of sound. In his instance, it had been 3 sharp sounds immediately following 3 unbelievable intense blows to his back and lower side. And because of the mountains, those 3 sounds had echoed. And the pain from those wounds still filled Holmes. He'd taken a second injection of the liquid heroin just before leaving the hotel. and he knew there would be no echo of the shot here in the cemetery. He reached the opening in the barrier of hedge and trees around the memorial without mishap, but paused just outside that entrance for a full minute so that his shadow from the lowering sun sending horizontal shafts of light through the trees should show his shape to maximum advantage. Then he entered. He was the first one there.
Good,
he thought, and crossed the triangular space to sit on the section of the three-sided concrete bench closest to St. Gaudens's statue. It was also the furthest from the opening in the hedge and would be invisible from anyone looking through any telescopic sight on the outside. If Lucan Adler wanted him tonight, he'd have to come within speaking range to have him. At 25 past the hour, just as the dusk was settling gently, a dark form filled the opening. Then it approached him through the twilight scent of newly mown grass. Holmes stood. Despite the years that had passed, Irene Adler looked no older to him than she had the last time he had seen her, nor any less beautiful. Far more beautiful than the opera ad image he'd shown other people. Contrary to style, she wore no gloves this evening, and her sleeves were cut short enough to show her pale, bare forearms. She carried a small cloth handbag.
Large enough for a two-shot Derringer pistol,
thought Holmes, and immediately banished such thoughts from his mind. Now, later, much later, it no longer mattered to Sherlock Holmes. He only knew that the young man in black had spoken the truth when he said, "The readiness is all."
Sherlock,
she said, and the sound of her voice moved something deep within him. She crossed the space, offered her hand in the American handshake mode, but he lifted it gently and kissed it.
Hello, Irene.
He pronounced her name the way she had taught him when they'd first met.
Irene.
He realized he was holding her hand for too long a period of time, and, suddenly embarrassed, he stepped back, gestured to the high-backed bench next to where he'd been seated closest to the sculpture, and said,
"Will you sit with me?"
"By all means,"
she said. They sat next to each other, silent, not quite touching, for what must have been a full 3 or 4 minutes. Holmes could sense that the leaves on the hedge behind them were moist with dew. The twilight deepened, but the stars were not yet visible. Finally, Adler said,
"Do we talk about us first, Sherlock? Or about this game we find ourselves in?"
"This is no game,"
said Holmes in a voice harder and sterner than he'd meant to use.
"Of course not,"
said Irene Adler, and looked down at her hands folded on the small bag on her lap.
"Let us speak of personal things first,"
Holmes said in an infinitely softer tone.
"Very well. Which of us should start?"
"You should, Irene,"
said Holmes. She turned a mock stern face to him in the dim light.
"Why did it take you almost 2 years to come to America to try to find me?"
she demanded. Holmes felt his face grow flushed. He looked down at her hands.
"No one told me that you'd gone back to America. No one told me that you were pregnant. I worked for almost a full year in British theater troops, looking for you."
"Idiot,"
said Irene Adler. Holmes could only nod.
"And you practicing and preparing during your entire childhood to become the world's first and foremost consulting detective,"
she said, but this time her tone was lighter, almost bantering. Holmes nodded again, but looked at her now.
"I never found you in my time in America, either," he said,
his voice sounding hollow even to his own ear. She reached with her right hand and laid it on both of his.
"That is because, as soon as I heard through the Player's secret telegraph wires that you had come to New York and Boston, I took the next ship to France."
"With the baby,"
said Holmes in something not quite a whisper.
"Yes."
Her answer had been even quieter.
"When did Colonel Moran take him from you?"
asked Holmes.
"When Lucan was 4 years old,"
said Irene Adler.
"The day after his 4th birthday.
"How could you let that brigand,"
began Holmes, and then fell silent.
"Because of the hold Colonel Moran had over me,"
said Adler. The same hold that Lucan now uses. Holmes, forgetting himself, took her by her upper arms, his strong hands then moving to her shoulders, as if he was about to draw her to him, or strangle her.
Irene, you're the strongest, bravest woman I've ever met. How could a cad like Sebastian Moran have such a hold over you that you would surrender your child to him?
Our child.
The last two words had emerged as a sort of moan.
Colonel Moran threatened to assassinate you if I did not do as he wished, she said tonelessly, just as Lucan does now.
Speechless, Holmes could communicate only by squeezing her arms more tightly. The pressure must have pained her, but she made no effort to pull away. She turned to him, setting her own hands on his upper arms, until they must have looked to some stranger most like two people consoling one another.
You live a careless life, Sherlock Holmes, she said fiercely, no hint of apology in her voice. You always have. That idiot doctor friend of yours, or Conan Doyle, I have no idea which, celebrates and publicizes your little front parlor detection victories as if you were Achilles. But you sit at your window in plain view. You walk the streets lost in thought, oblivious to almost everything around you. You let the world know your street address and your daily habits. Colonel Moran, or others like him, have not long since murdered you because I've done what they want.
Holmes dropped his hands and sat brooding for a long moment. Finally,
but the child.
The child is evil, snapped Irene Adler. The child was evil at birth.
Holmes' head snapped backward as if he'd been slapped.
No child can be evil from birth, for God's sake. It must take years, parenting, evil influences. You didn't hold this baby to your breast and watch its first actions, said Adler in a totally cold voice. One of his first acts was to pluck the wings off a butterfly I was showing him, and he enjoyed it. It was as if I'd given birth to another Coriolanus.
But even Coriolanus was shaped by...
He stopped.
His mother,
cried Irene Adler, as if in physical pain.
Volpone bragged to her hag friends about how her little boy Coriolanus loved to torture animals, give pain to any living thing. But never in the 4 years that I was with Lucan did I ever give him anything but love and training to love and respect others.
She turned her face away and moved away from him on the bench. He closed the distance again.
I was going to say that Coriolanus was shaped by warped Roman values, whispered Sherlock. That's always been my understanding of what Shakespeare was trying to say.
Irene Adler laughed, and it was a bitter, sad sound.
Don't you remember, Sherlock? We met in London during Henry Irving's troupe's presentation of Coriolanus. I, a veteran of theater, playing the old hag Volpone at the advanced age of 22, and you, an 18-year-old understudy, fleeing your first months of schooling in Cambridge, wet behind the ears and everywhere else.
I've forgotten everything about the play, said Holmes, but remembered every other second of our time together.
She touched his cheek with the backs of her fingers.
You are so young, my dear.
Holmes took her in his arms. She seemed to resist for a second or two, and then melted into him. Then she set her hand on his chest and firmly pushed him away.
Now, she said, shall we discuss this not-a-game game we find ourselves in?
Holmes couldn't speak for a moment, and when he did, his voice was ragged.
All right. What horrible thing first?
She'd obviously meant her tone to be light, but it came out as choked with emotion as Holmes's voice.
The annual typed cards on December 6th, he said.
He could tell immediately that she had no idea what he was talking about. She was a consummate actress, but Holmes now had decades of experience studying liars' faces and eyes when they lied. She was not faking her lack of understanding.
What cards? I put flowers on Clover's grave every December 6th. White violets, she loved them,
and I've sent a few flowers to Henry Adams on that date. But I've never included a card.
Ned Hooper, Clover's brother, came to see me in London 2 years ago. He's dead now, by the way, said Holmes. He offered me $2,000 and said he wanted me to solve the mystery of a card that each of the four surviving members of the Five of Hearts receives each December 6, and has since December 86. It's typed, and always says the same thing. She was murdered.
Irene Adler stared at him.
That's barbarous. I would never do that. There'd be no reason for Lucan to do that. No, he never would.
Holmes nodded.
I didn't think it was either of you, but I owe it to Ned's memory and the $1 retainer he paid me in 1891 to ask.
That was the year that the papers said you died,
Irene Adler said quietly.
In Switzerland, while fighting with some Professor Moriarty whom no one had ever heard of.
Holmes nodded again.
I didn't believe it then, said Adler, and I didn't believe it the next year when Lucan bragged that he'd killed you in Tibet.
Holmes smiled.
He nearly did. He put 3 rifle bullets through my back at a distance of almost a mile.
She seemed startled.
I'd always assumed he was lying. How could you survive 3 strikes like that from the kind of rifles Lucan uses?
I don't know, said Holmes. But let's talk about Rebecca Lorne.
The words clicked into place like the clack-clack of a bolt-action rifle bringing a live round into the chamber.
Was it for blackmail?
Of course, said Adler.
Why Clover and Henry Adams?
They were rich. She was weak. At the time, in 1885, Lucan needed money for what he had to do in Europe. Blackmailing the Adamses was an obvious way. Clover was so lonely and lost that I became her best friend in 2 days.
But you continued the pretense for 7 months, snapped Holmes.
After the first days, it was no pretense,
Irene Adler said softly.
I did like Clover. I admired her talent, as a person, as a photographer, far more than her arrogant, self-centered husband ever had. He used every possible chance to make her feel less important, less capable, less than an equal human being. Have you read his novel Esther, that came out not long before she died?
Yes, said Holmes.
It's obviously a portrait of her. Of poor Clover, and she's shown to be foolish and inept in her art, foolish in her life, and always dependent upon some merciful man for anything she might ever need or reach for in her life. If I'd had a husband who wrote a novel like that about me, I would have shot him twice. The second bullet to the head to put him out of the misery of where I'd put the first round.
Yes, said Holmes,
and smiled this time.
So you'd asked why I made her a victim, continued Irene.
Holmes nodded.
I thought it was the fastest way to get Lucan out of her life, she said bitterly. My dear cousin Clifton, a mere boy.
Her white hands became white fists in the dim light.
A mere boy who was a cancer which needed thousands of dollars to go back to Europe to murder someone alongside his hero. The great tiger-hunting Colonel Sebastian Moran.
How did he, Lucan, find out about the romantic letter Henry Adams had sent Lizzie Cameron? Asked Holmes. I presume that was the direction your blackmail took.
Irene Adler made a noise like a small dog choking.
Of course. That circle of friends was so small and so inbred that even young Lucan knew that there would be scandal just beneath the surface. After I'd become dear friends with Clover and thus allowed into that tiny little circle of highest society ladies, Lizzie Cameron herself bragged to me of Henry Adams's love letter to her. Lucan had said that there must be something, and in the end we didn't even have to dig. One of Clover's closest friends, quotation marks all around that phrase,
gave us, gave me, the deadly dagger with a laugh.
Why did you go with Clover to see Lizzie Cameron on her sickbed 36 hours before Clover's death? Asked Holmes.
I wanted Lizzie to deny that any such letter existed, said Adler. I'd asked her, Lizzie, just hours before to deny it. She finally said she would.
And did she?
She wouldn't. She was ill with the flu, and all of her darker humors were in full control of her. She teased poor, silly Clover about the existence of the letter, playing dumb about it one minute, obviously acknowledging its existence the next. I almost strangled the woman in her four-posted silken canopied bed. Clover went home that night certain that she'd so failed her husband Henry at being his real wife, as she always put it. She was terrified of sexual intercourse, you see. It was always strange and painful to her. That she decided that everything, including her husband's cheating attentions to Lizzie Cameron, was her fault.
I can't see how driving Clover Adams to suicide could help Lucan or you in any way, said Holmes. That's always been the sticking point of this conundrum.
Not a very complicated one, said Adler. Lucan had found other funding for his list of assassinations, steady funding. Funding he has even today. He no longer had to wait for a neurotic woman to help us blackmail her husband.
Did Lucan poison Clover Adams? Asked Holmes.
The long silence seemed to make the gathering darkness deeper.
I don't know, said Irene Adler at last. I know he brought the poison to her bedroom that Sunday morning, and the glass from downstairs. Suspecting that he would try something to get rid of her. She knew Cousin Clifton too well to be on her guard. I rushed to her house that morning, but she was already dead on the floor. I heard footsteps on the servants' stairs, Lucan leaving, I believe. But somehow I don't think he forced the poison down her throat, or even allowed her to see him, for that matter. It was just the bottle of potassium cyanide that had strangely moved from her photographic laboratory and the mysterious appearance of that single drinking glass that sent her off the edge. Perhaps she took it as a message from her husband. Or God.
After another silence.
But I was still as complicit in Clover Adams' death as Lucan was, whatever he did or didn't do. I even took the glass away in my handbag before I went down to meet Henry Adams returning from his walk.
When you say he has steady funding, whom are you speaking of? Said Holmes. The anarchists?
Irene Adler laughed. It sounded almost authentic this time. Holmes remembered that she'd always had a beautiful laugh.
The anarchists have no money to speak of, my darling, said Irene Adler. They're anarchists, for God's sake. Most of them can't even find work in the factories where their fathers work. They're so drunk or crazy or lazy.
Then who? Said Sherlock.
I saw Lucan on Saturday,
said Irene Adler.
He bragged about following you and that writer you've been dragging around with you all through the Chicago World's Fairgrounds. You were within 50 yards of an entire building at the fair dedicated to one of the primary companies funding Colonel Moran and Lucan Adler. They provide the list of targets to be assassinated, and you didn't even peek into the building.
Krupp, Holmes said at last.
Of course.
Colonel Rice had gone on about how one of the great highlights of the World's Fair, at least for men and boys, was to be Krupp's baby. A 250,000-pound cannon so large that it needed its own building, tucked in between the agriculture building and the lake. The cannon, built by Fritz Krupp's Essen Works, was said to be capable of firing a 1-ton shell 20 miles and still penetrate 3 feet of wrought iron armor plating. Since the building hadn't been in a sniper's line of sight with the administration building, Holmes had had no interest in it.
What do they want to come from these random assassinations? Asked Holmes,
and heard the one-syllable answer in his own mind a split second before Irene Adler spoke it aloud.
War.
Where? anywhere will suit them, she said, as long as the major European powers are involved. From the list that Lucan has mentioned, I believe they place their fondest hopes for the fire starting in the Balkans.
Then why on earth kill an American president? Said Holmes.
A little test, said Adler, and an easy one. American presidents are always so accessible, aren't they?
Do you know where Lucan will be shooting from, Irene? His choice of a sniper's roost?
No.
He seized her upper arms again and squeezed hard enough to make a large man cry for mercy. But all the time he was looking into her eyes in the last of that April twilight. She was telling the truth. He let her go and said, I'm sorry.
I know that he expects you to figure out his shooting position, she said softly.
Holmes noticed that she did not rub what must now be her bruised arms.
Why?
Because he's already told me that he'll be killing you at almost the same time he will kill President Cleveland.
Do you know when he'll kill the president?
He hasn't told me, but I know Lucan,
said Irene Adler.
He'll shoot Cleveland during his short speech, when everyone is quiet and attentive. It will be the brightest spotlight on Lucan Adler's genius. He even described it in those terms.
Do you know how he plans to escape? Asked Holmes.
Not from wherever his sniper's roost might be, said Adler. But I know the vested interests who are paying him have bought the swift-sailing ship the Zephyr, and it will be waiting for Lucan in the lake just offshore. According to Lucan, the Zephyr, with its sails, its German-trained racing crew, and new steam-engine-driven propellers, can outrun any police boat or yacht on the Great Lakes.
Thank you for that, said Holmes. Thank you for everything.
Irene Adler touched her locket, opened it, and held it up in the failing light. And for a second, Holmes thought she might have a daguerreotype of him or some lock of his hair in there, but it was only a miniature watch. She said softly,
Our hour is up, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Ill met by moonlight? He asked.
She smiled without effort, the way he remembered her smiling freely when he was not quite 19 years old.
That's not the inconstant moon over the hedgetops, my lovelorn Romeo, she said. It's one of the gaslights along the paved road in the cemetery.
He stood when she did. He made no move, and neither did she. Then she turned toward the lighter opening in the monument's hedged-in space, and he walked half a step behind her.
I'll see you to your carriage, he said, taking her arm.
They walked that way across the dew-wet grass where headstones were becoming vague and vaguely threatening in constant outlines in the last of the twilight. There were sidelights burning on her elegant enclosed coach. Holmes had an instant's perfect image of Lucan Adler thrusting his arm out the door of the coach and shooting him in the chest with a Colt 45 pistol. He shook his head once, waving the eager driver doorman aside, and helped Irene Adler step up into her empty coach.
When shall we meet again? Asked Holmes, still holding the door as she settled into the cushioned bench.
Oh, at your funeral or my hanging is most likely, said Irene Adler.
No,
said Sherlock Holmes in a voice so loud and so commanding that the horse twitched its tail in alarm and the driver turned around on his box. She leaned forward and kissed him passionately on the lips. With her hands still on his cheek, she said softly,
Now to scape the serpent's tongue. We will make amends ere long. Give me your hands if we be friends.
Holmes immediately took both her hands in his and squeezed them.
And luck or providence shall restore amends.
She pulled the door shut and cried,
Drive on, driver.
Holmes stood there for a while in the dark. Then he walked back to Clover Adams's grave, stopped at the granite back of the monument, and pounded on it with his fist. The stone door hinged open. Chief of the Treasury Department, Andrew L. Drummond, stepped out and pushed the granite shut behind him.
Did you hear it all?
Asked Holmes in a strained monotone.
Yes,
everything, said Drummond. It shall be very helpful.
He gripped Holmes's forearm in a man's more aggressive way than Irene had done just a few minutes earlier.
Holmes, the personal things. I swear to you upon my word of honor, upon my children's lives, that no one shall ever hear a word of them from me.
Holmes shrugged as if to say he'd known how naked and vulnerable he would be after this session.
We'll find and start following the Zephyr immediately, said Drummond.
Holmes nodded tiredly.
But let it anchor there near the World's Fair, he said in the same monotone as before. Nothing must let Lucan Adler know that we're on to his plan.
We'll have to put Miss Adler under arrest, said Drummond.
Not now, for Christ's sake, exploded Holmes. We'd just as well send Lucan Adler a telegram saying that we were on to him. Follow her if you can do so subtly, and I mean so totally subtly that a snake like Lucan Adler wouldn't spot the tail. But better yet leave her alone, unfollowed, and free until...
His voice trailed off.
Until when? Asked Drummond.
Until I tell you otherwise, said Holmes, and turned to walk away.
Behind him, Agent Drummond blew a police whistle, and more than a dozen men, shadows among shadows, came from behind distant trees, boulders, headstones, and monuments to join their chief. Wagons were arriving at the park entrance. By their lamps, Holmes could see that most of the men were armed with pistols, as Drummond had been, but several carried long guns. None of them could have stopped Lucan Adler from shooting Sherlock Holmes. The sniper would have been too concealed for that. But the plan had been to capture Lucan after the fatal shot had revealed his position. Holmes was waved into a comfortable open carriage that would carry just him and Drummond back into town. Remembering the timbre of Irene Adler's voice, Holmes surprised Drummond by crying,
"Drive on, driver!"
3. Early on the morning of Friday, the 29th of April, Henry Adams and Henry James rode together to the main railway station to meet the special train that Henry Cabot Lodge had laid on for them. It was a short ride, but Adams used it for what he obviously thought was an important conversation.
"Harry," he said, leaning forward toward the portly rider, "I need to tell you, before we meet up with all the others, how very important your visit has been to me the last 2 weeks."
James's gray eyes came alert.
"And to me as well, Henry. I shall always treasure the hospitality and our nightly conversations." "And did you get some work done on your play?"
James smiled ruefully.
"Some. Then rewrote it. Then rewrote it again. Then I tossed it all out. But I did start to expand a short story I'd written, a slight thing about an impoverished tutor who loves the young child in his care more than do the child's careless parents."
"It sounds all too real," said Adams.
James made a slight gesture with his hand.
"I shall see. Thank you for allowing me to speak freely about Clover, her life as well as her death, after my years of silence.